All right. Welcome to the Aging Well Together show. We have a special bonus program today. We have the Aging Well Together show. We have a fabulous and fascinating show today, all about how we create more supportive and accessible environments in our homes and in our communities, especially as we age. But before we dive into our show topic, I want to give a shout out to WCOMLP Chapel Hill Carrboro on 103.5 for hosting our weekly Aging Well Together show and our bonus show this week. We are generally on Thursdays from 2 to 3, but occasionally, like today, we have a special edition. The Aging Well Together show is also available to stream anytime on WCOMFM.org and through streaming services, including TuneIn Radio and Radio Garden. So many thanks for listening to us in any way we're coming to you. The Aging Well Together show is brought to you by the wonderfully helpful team from the Orange County Department on Aging. Please join us each week as we interview special guests like we're doing today to share information, resources, insights, and stories about the opportunities for aging well together. If you want more information on any of the issues we discuss or to suggest a topic for an upcoming show, you can email us at agingwelltogethershow@gmail.com or please connect with the Orange County Department on Aging, and they can be reached. Hopefully you're not driving, so wait till you're home with a piece of paper and a pencil, but they can be reached at 919-968-2070 or through their website at orangecountync.gov/aging. I do want to give a shout out to the Carrboro-based band, the Robert Bradford Quartet. You heard just a few moments of their awesome original music, Mayfly, and at the end of the show, I'll play it longer so you can enjoy their music. And for me, I am your happy host, Heather Altman. This is my 10th show. I am loving doing Aging Well Together. I've spent the last 20 plus years working in aging services locally, and I'm also a caregiver for older family members. And now at 52, I'm focusing on my own changing needs, so I am super invested in how we are all aging well together. And I'm also super excited and invested in talking with today's guest. We have Esther Greenhouse, who is the CEO of Silver to Gold Strategic Consulting. She's a built environment strategist and an industry scholar with the Cornell Institute for Healthy Futures. Esther is also an environmental gerontologist on a mission to end disabling and discriminatory housing and communities by creating places, policies, and initiatives for equitable and accessible housing, caregiving, and community development solutions that enable people to thrive across the lifespan and ability span. Wow, that's a lot to get into and a lot to discuss, but first, welcome, Esther.
Thank you so much for having me, Heather.
Okay, great. I just want to make sure microphone is well on. It's so great to have you here.
I'm glad to be here. I'm looking forward to this conversation. Oh. We always have great conversations.
I know, we do. We do. And this time we have an audience. So this is exciting for us. So there is so much to dive into from your introduction alone. And also I've done a bunch of reading and stalking about you. So there's so much for you to teach me and our listeners. But before you tell us what an environmental gerontologist is and does, as well as a built environment strategist, you have like the coolest titles. But first, tell us about yourself, where you're from, and what brought your focus to gerontology. There's a lot there.
There is a lot there. So I grew up on Long Island and ended up going to Cornell University. And the reason I went to Cornell was partially following my high school sweetheart, who then became my husband, Brooke. But it was also because I read in the university brochure about a program which was then called Design and Environmental Analysis. It's called Human-Centered Design now. And there was something in the brochure that said something to the effect of the built environment will affect a person's functioning and behavior, no matter how well or how poorly it is designed.
Nice.
And that was a life-changing moment for me. We ended up staying in Ithaca after graduation. We lived there for about 30 years. And then we were ready for a change. And last year, we relocated to Chapel Hill, which is how I ended up meeting you.
Welcome, like many of us coming from up north. Sorry yes. for local people that have been born and bred here. We do represent Northerners who fell in love with the Chapel Hill area. So I want to just... So you went and you did this program at Cornell, and I love that concept of the built environment can really, I'm not sure exactly, make or break how you do, because most people think it's their own body and their own ability that makes or break their success and environment, but you really took a much more environmental approach. So what did that program teach you, and how did you decide, I want to be an environmental gerontologist? And by the way, I've been in gerontology for years, and I hadn't heard that term until you and I met at a reception.
Exactly. So there are not a lot of environmental gerontologists. And when I was in that program as an undergraduate, there was a point when I was taking an environmental psychology class, and we were studying how different types of environments affect different populations. And when we started to read the research on how older adults were impacted by the design of urban environments, mm-hmm. I had another life-changing moment. I mean, I really felt like the heavens parted, and there was this almost like a tap on my shoulder, like, yes, the angels are singing, focus on this.
And what does that mean, like, in their urban environment and how, I mean, I can guess, but.
So it's a lot of actually what was the start of the WHO, the World Health Organization's Age Friendly Cities Initiative, which started in, I think, 2007. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is very simple. So things like, do you have sidewalks that you can walk on? Are the sidewalks heaving and crumbling? Is there lighting at night or in dark days? Are there places to sit and rest? Mm-hmm. Is there shade? Wow. Is there public transportation?
Especially now.
Yes. The beautiful sunshine is appreciated. But so it's really looking at how does the human-made environment really support people's functioning? Mm-hmm. Or does it create a lot of barriers?
Yeah. When I was taking a course a few years ago, I was part of a course at UNC looking at community development. And one of the big issues that came up was the timing of crosswalks.
Yes.
And so it assumed a certain amount of steps per second, and that it didn't connect with those who might be walking a bit slower, maybe walking with assisted devices, that you can't get across the street literally when the walk sign. And to me, that was one of the most basic examples of a community design feature that was like, have it go from 9 seconds to 12 seconds, or it literally got down to that point. And I was like, oh yeah, that's a really good point.
Yes. And I've been glad to see over the past 10 to 20 years that really changing in the U.S. Part of it has been spearheaded by volunteer work done through AARP. And I actually participated in my own community doing this years ago. My son was maybe 10 at the time. He helped me. And a bunch of us community citizens got together, and at certain crosswalks, we took notes. We said, what is happening at this intersection? How much time is needed? And like many other volunteers in their own communities, we then submitted it to the municipality, and they consider extending the time of crosswalks. And I have to say, I was in Washington, D.C. a few weeks ago, and I was really impressed by the length of time on the crosswalks. And I'd just like to take this opportunity to start introducing a concept that's really essential to my work. It's not just about the old people.
I'm so glad. I wanted to talk about that. Keep going. Yes.
Yes. And unfortunately, in our society, we're ageist and we're ableist. Mm-hmm. And at the very least, if we don't think we have negative perceptions of age or disability, we certainly tend to have this concept that people with disabilities and frail elders are not a part of society and the community, and they're off segregated somewhere. And that's really extremely far from true. Over 90% of older adults live in traditional housing. They don't live in a senior living community. They don't live in a nursing home. They don't live in assisted living or a CCRC. They live out in the community with everyone else. Mm-hmm. Many people with disabilities, most people with disabilities, are living in the community. And the other thing is I know it's human nature to try to categorize things, right? Yes. That's crucial that we think in that way. But what happens is we tend to think that people are just one note, yeah, one variable. Mm-hmm. And so you can have a disability and be the CEO of a company. Mm-hmm. You can be
or governor of a state.
Or a governor in a state. Yeah. Or you can be 75 and a congressperson and a mother and a grandmother and XYZ. You know, so people have a lot of different things. We also tend to think about disabilities as just a few specific things, specific characteristics like just mobility, or maybe you're visually impaired. Mm-hmm. And typically we think of that as just you can see or you're blind. And I actually have some invisible disabilities, and one of them is I have a visual processing disorder. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's all about how my brain processes visual information, which makes it very challenging for me to read, and it's made it hard for me to learn math, because in this country we do vertical and horizontal equations. Yes. So my point is that people are very complex, and it really improves our chances of serving everybody well and having thriving communities by understanding that there's a lot of complexity and not this one note, and people that aren't integral to society.
Well, and I know, thank you so much for that sort of background and overview and context of it. And I know that when we talk in my space, since I've been in the aging space for a while, we talk about age-friendly or age-ready communities, but really the term that comes up more often is a livable community, mm-hmm, a community that is age-friendly, using the sidewalks and the crosswalks example, perfect. If it's age-friendly, it's livable for all, so it's good for wheelchairs, also good for those of us pushing strollers. So it is supportive of everyone, and I think these issues of access and equity for all, mm-hmm, and just creating that environment for everyone to be successful or literally just get from A to B where they want to go. So all this sort of, it sounds like it informs your work into, I keep going back to the environmental gerontologist and the work that you do as a built strategist. I was reading about you, and I love how you're described as a catalyst for positive change. You bring nearly 30 years of experience and a unique constellation of experience in design gerontology, environmental psychology, and planning to help communities and organizations solve real problems. There's a lot of words there, but I was so curious. We've talked about a few, but what are the real problems that you're seeing that you feel really need more attention and that you're able to bring some insight in? How's that for a... I did have fun stalking you. There's really good things about you.
Well, this work is fascinating, and this is my life's mission. And you asked a lot of questions in there, and
I
I'm going to try to pull out a few to answer. So first of all, an environmental gerontologist is someone who focuses on the relationship between older adults and the built environment.
Mm-hmm.
And the work that I do, rather than focusing on design, there are designers who specialize in places for older adults. I typically focus on strategy. So I work with municipalities. I consult for municipalities. I consult for major organizations like AARP International. I co-developed with them an initiative called Equity by Design, and that's to create equitable and enabling multi-generational housing and communities. So we all know the term equitable or equity. The other pillar is enabling, which comes from the enabling design approach, which I created. You can find more information about that on my website, which is www.silvertogoldstrategies.com. And there's a specific page on enabling design. And I'll just tell you briefly what the enabling design approach is.
Thank you. Because I had a whole question. I saw that. And so we were going to get to that. But yes, please tell me what enabling design means in your approach.
Yes. So really, the essence is that there are three pillars to the enabling design approach. The first comes from a theory in environmental psychology research. The formal name is the environmental docility hypothesis, but
okay.
Yeah, right. And but when you distill it down to its essence, really, this is often referred to as environmental fit.
Yes.
So it's a very simple and very powerful theory. So when there's a good fit between a person and their environment, they can function at their highest level of independence.
Yes.
The problem is, the greater the gap between a person's abilities and what the environment demands of them, the more they are subjected to a form of stress, which is called environmental press.
Mm-hmm.
It literally pushes them to an artificially lower level of functioning. And we see this in terms of design, whether it's the design of products or places. I'll give you a few examples. I'm 5'1".
Yes, you're taller than me.
Oh.
Yes, give examples. So yes, perfect. Let's talk about us lovely short women.
Yes. So I'm 5'1". And that is not short enough to meet any requirements for having a disability, right? Nobody would agree that I should get a check from the government every month. But every single day, I am struggling to function. The seat pans and chairs are too deep. The seats in cars, even with all the modifications that you can make, are too deep. I can't reach things. But I'll give you an example of where it really matters. Let's say I'm working in an office environment.
Mm-hmm.
The chair is too deep for me. I can't properly reach the desk. My arms are at an angle, so I'm shrugging up my shoulders. After a couple of days, I'm going to be going home at the end of the day with pain in my neck, pain in my wrists. But over time, those are going to worsen, and likely I'll develop carpal tunnel syndrome. And it can easily be addressed by slightly shifting the environment to make sure that I can function properly.
It's like the ergonomics. And if our listeners were seeing me right now, I'm sitting cross-legged in a chair where my feet can't touch the ground. So, yes, I wouldn't want to do this 40 hours a week, but it works for this. So,
yes.
But, yeah, that whole – these are great examples. Tell me more. I was thinking more the staircase. I deal with that with my family and with other folks that I'm working with. If you have to walk upstairs to get to your bedroom, to get mm-hmm. to your bathroom, that's going to be an environment that may be limiting if you start to have issues with your mobility, with your knees, your hips. So anyway, other examples, that was the one I always go to.
And you're right, the desk example, workstation example is ergonomics. So I used to include a photo in my visual presentations of a woman in a wheelchair. And you could tell that that woman was strong and athletic. She was young. And then I would zoom out on the photo and you could see that there was a staircase in front of her.
Yeah.
And so it's a really helpful perspective to think about how much is she limited by non-traditional mobility and how much is she limited by the design of the environment. Because if there was an elevator, if there the building was one level, it wouldn't be an issue that she was in a wheelchair.
Yeah, and aren't we in Disability Awareness Month right now? And haven't
today is the day, is the anniversary of the ADA. Yes.
I was going to say, and we're celebrating the Americans with Disability Act, right? Which was all about let's not create limits. Let's make sure that if we have different disabilities, we can still use our community buildings. We can still work in environments. Okay, keep going. That's fascinating. And how fun that we're, how apropos for our conversation today.
Yes. So so I invite people to look around as they're going to public places to see how well they think those places would work for a person, for example, with a mobility disability, like somebody who uses a wheelchair or a walker. And while the ADA was groundbreaking civil rights legislation and the corresponding accessibility design guidelines were monumental in shifting, we still have a long way to go. So I'll give you two specific issues. One is the ADA does not apply to single-family residential housing, mm-hmm. where the vast majority of people in our society live, and the vast majority of older adults. Again, over 90% of older adults live in traditional housing. So we're not even touching most home environments. The other thing is that there are a lot of places that don't meet the ADA requirements for a bunch of reasons. Maybe they had an exception. Maybe the work was not quite done exactly. And I had a lot of experiences seeing this firsthand because I was the primary caregiver to my mother for over 10 years. Mm-hmm. And taking her in a wheelchair or prior to that when she used a walker, it was amazing how many places we would go, fairly recently built places, where we would get a parking spot that was accessible, and then there was no accessible path
to get in,
to get into the building. Yeah. And so we would have to walk or wheel out in the parking lot where traffic was passing us by and trying to avoid us.
Yeah, thanks for the spot, but now we can't get into the building. So,
right.
And I, you know, other environments are, what is it, you know, grandfathered in, and, you know, they don't actually sometimes have to get to code. All right, so that's those are the great examples, and then there's another one. And then there's two more pillars, yes.
Right, so those were the two examples. And then we're starting with this concept of we really want to create environments that are a good fit for people of a range of abilities so they can be as independent as possible. The second pillar is recognizing that the status quo of what we've built in this country and our standards and conventions and codes for how we design and build are disabling and discriminatory.
Yes, go on. You are not mincing words.
No, no. I, like I said, this is my life's work. We mm-hmm. really need to shift our understanding of the environments we create because we have the ability to minimize the negative impacts. I mean, it's really like, I mean, I'm getting all excited this because there's so much potential. It doesn't have to be this way. So I'll put this in context of,
story. Yes, give us examples and stories. Go on.
So I would say about 20 years ago, I was doing a lot of work on this topic. I was speaking at conferences and I was involved in different organizations. And when I would speak with people like municipal leaders, builders, developers, designers, architects, you know, a lot of people would say, oh, it would be great to be inclusive of the needs of older adults. But we can't really design for a subset of the population.
I've heard that too. And it becomes this weird chicken and egg. We're not going to do it until people say they want it, but people don't. Yeah, okay, keep going.
Right. And and my response is, great, then you'll join me on this mission, because that's exactly how we design and build now. Mm-hmm. We create environments that are ideal for the average height male, so somewhere around 5'9", mm-hmm. Who has high physical, sensory, and cognitive abilities. That means that we really are creating places that are ideal for the average height male between the ages of 20 and 40, 20 and 50. Because by the time we're 50, almost all of us have measurable changes to our hearing and vision mm-hmm. that are completely normal. Mm-hmm. So that's the second pillar, is understanding that we're not designing properly. And I used to teach at Cornell University. I taught studio courses. I taught a course on my work, the enabling design approach. And, you know, the students were terrific. But I use this example to say, in terms of how we are building and designing things, now that we know better, if my students had designed products and places as they are now, I would make them redo the project.
Really?
Because we are not designing for the real range of people's sizes, behaviors, mm-hmm. and abilities. So that brings me to the third pillar.
Yeah. Now,
which is let's look at the world through those two lenses. Let's look at the problems in our community, like the long-term care crisis, mm-hmm. the caregiving crisis. Let's look at issues with employment. I mean, I've been brought into municipalities that had issues of you know, lack of affordable housing, out-migration of young people, in-migration of older people. So let's look at the problems that we're facing through those two lenses, and let's say what policies and programs are acting as levers or barriers. Mm-hmm. So one thing I always do when I work with a municipality is I am respectful of how do you want to do things? Do you want mostly the private market to lead this? Do you want government to mostly lead this? But the big thing to recognize is that whatever works best for your community, it's essentially a closed system. You can't have one or the other. There, it's interdependency. So you need to identify what, for example, if you want the private market to lead, you want incentives, you have to collaborate with the government on eliminating whatever barriers are in the way, what things can act as really strong levers to help the private industry make these solutions.
So what kind, keep going, yeah, and then I have a follow-up.
And then you also have to look at economics and the cost-benefit analysis. So I'll give you an example that's very personal. So when my mom was around 80, which was about 13 years ago, my husband and I were building a new home for ourselves, and we told her, there's a lot next door. We'll design and build a house for you, and our goal with the design of that house is to enable you to retain your physical and financial independence as long as possible. Mm-hmm. Essentially also saying, we want to help you delay or prevent ever having to move to a facility unless you choose to. And we designed that house for her, and we provided care for her. And the features of that house enabled her to delay moving to a facility by 5 to 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
That saves a family over $500,000. I don't know what it would have saved the government. I also could ask the municipality we were in and the state we were in, how much were they saving just in terms of, like, if she had needed services while aging in place in her home. So the last pillar of the enabling design approach is do the economics. What is it costing you to have places that are not properly built? Because I know what it is. The way our housing and communities are designed, they are unnecessarily pushing older adults to lower levels of functioning, higher levels of dependency. They're in some cases creating what I call forced frailty.
Mm-hmm.
And they are exacerbating decline. Well, when we're in a phase in our a period in our society where we have an exponentially growing number of older adults and a correspondingly shrinking population of younger potential caregivers, right? We're going from 1 to 7.
That caregiving ratio,
right, that
is
caregiving
changing.
Ratio to, and I think 2040 or 2015, it'll be going from 1 older adult to every 7 potential caregivers to 1 to 3.
Yep. I've seen
that. Okay, so we are going to have humanitarian crises if we don't address that, which is one of the reasons that my firm is developing an initiative called Tackling the Caregiving Crisis by Design. Let's change the way we design our housing and communities to enable people to retain their physical independence, to retain their financial independence, and help communities and states retain their finances as well.
Yeah, there's so much exciting work that you are a part of and so much I want to follow up on. But I do want to call out, and we've talked before, and I know from your work that I love that you shared your own personal story with caregiving, and I know it's a passion of yours. And I really love how you share that experience and you calculate what you see the costs were that you were able to defer by doing this work. And there's a lot of national numbers about the actual economic cost, but mm-hmm. I love that you did it with your own family. And
I have another example.
Curious. Keep on keeping on.
So another interesting example was my mother, when we built her house, she wanted a bidet seat.
Yes.
So my husband researched it. He found a great bidet seat that you could attach to a standard toilet. He put in a dedicated outlet for it. And if a consumer would do it and have a licensed electrician put it in, you know, depending on the cost of the bidet seat, you're looking at $500 to $1,000, maybe mm-hmm. more if you're getting something really fancy. Because my mother used the bidet seat every time she used the toilet,
mm-hmm.
she never had a urinary tract infection. So I don't know what that saved the insurance company and Medicare and so on. And she was so clean that she was able to have one less shower a week,
mm-hmm.
which sometimes I did, but we had an aide that came once a week to shower her, to do mm-hmm. to help her with some things in the house. And saving one aide visit a week was approximately $100 a week savings. So,
yeah,
you know, depending on how many years, I think over 7 years, we saved like over $30,000.
Oh, my gosh. And I would love to have a show, and it is an interesting topic, but it's amazing the power of the bidet. I'm a huge fan, and a lot of people talk about Dr. Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal, and talks about the power of the bidet because someone can remain independent, can manage their own, which is a dignity.
Dignity.
It's a personal care. If you can manage, you don't need to bring in the sensitivity and the vulnerability and the cost of bringing another person. So, and you can get them really inexpensive now. You can do the tushy ones. That's the they should be a sponsor of the show. They're not. That doesn't need a dedicated electrical. Like, we're really into this in my family, and so we have both the fancy ones that need a dedicated electrical line and the ones that. But it's these things. And again, even going back to that first pillar, the environment fit. Are exactly. you being supported?
And oh, you're a great student, Heather.
I took notes.
But you're
I have
exactly
it here.
Right. And that's
and
exactly
I live this.
What I was going to say is that my mother had the dignity, and that design of that product filled the gap between her abilities and her needs. You know, and it did it in a way that was respectful. You know, that's the other thing. So there's a term called universal design, which
yes.
your audience might have heard of. Universal design is the design of products, places, and it can be other things like education, IT, to meet the needs of the widest range of abilities as possible without the need for specialization,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's the one thing I've very sadly seen about universal design is nothing wrong with universal design at all. It's in the interpretation.
Yes, yes. Keep going, because it's cute. Esther keeps giving me, for our listeners, these motions. She's like, I want to keep going. Keep going, and then I will amen and add on to that.
Mm-hmm. So one of the big things is that universal design, because it's often talked about and taught with concepts of being inclusive of older adults, being inclusive of people with disabilities, there's been a conflation of it. People tend
yes.
to think that that's the primary audience.
Yeah.
And because we tend to be uncomfortable with or fear age and disability, we want to be at arm's length from universal design.
Yes.
Which is horrible, because we are really missing out. So these perceptions have really delayed the application of UD. The
yeah.
second point is that I will speak to designers or builders who know of UD, and they're all excited about UD, and turns out they don't really get it. And
yeah.
I'll tell you why. If you really understand universal design, it becomes your default.
Yes.
And that's really the only thing it should be. You learn UD, that's the way you design.
And I think the concern that I've heard over the years, or the critique, is that universal design, accessible design, sometimes in practice equals sterile design or clinical, which is not at all what it's supposed to be. And I've heard, have you heard the term transcendental design? I know the Joe Coughlin, who runs the Age Lab out of MIT, he was trying to find a different word to say you can have universal design that's also aesthetically pleasing, that is marketable.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just about basic sterile handrails and metal ramps outside of home. But again, how can you build up the ground so you have a beautiful step-free entrance, but
right.
still retains the market value of the house? How can you just automatically build doorways that are big enough to accommodate, or in your, you know, kitchens, different size countertops?
Yes.
And that it can be beautiful and aesthetic. And so that's what I hear.
Right.
And I love that it should just become a part of what you do.
It should be the standard for how we design and build everything. Because how are you able to predict, when you design a space, who is going to use it? You think everybody is going to be, and I hate this term, but quote unquote, able-bodied.
Yeah.
And they're all going to be approximately 5'9" and be able to do everything that the space is. You can't predict that. That's not, and we know that's not our population. We just have to look at the data. It's there.
Yeah.
But I think that ties into a message that you and I were talking about before we started the show, which is helping people to understand that, especially as you age, or if you have changes to your abilities for other reasons, I really want people to pull away from the notion that there's something wrong with them.
Yeah.
Because you need to open your eyes and see that so much is designed against most people.
Yeah. Oh, great point. So you're right, because if you're not fitting into this chair like I'm not fitting into, or you're not fitting into environments, you think, well, what's wrong with me, as yep. opposed to the environment. I have two questions. So I don't know if you've answered it a little bit, because as I was thinking about talking with you today, and I'm still not sure, I was thinking about your passion area, whether you lean more towards caring's the wrong word, but your focus area about being what's in the home and helping people as they think through and design their home, mm-hmm. as opposed to these larger, when you're working with municipalities, with governments, and thinking how they design their communities. So I was curious, and I because it seems like you're just so interested in both.
Yes.
And so do you find that you're doing equal love, or is that you focus more on the home or focus more on community development, because your expertise spans both of them?
Right. So very little of my work has been directly with consumers in the mm-hmm. home environment. For many years, I was a national instructor for the National Association of Home Builders. A lot of people don't know, unfortunately, even in aging services, I've found this, a lot of people don't know that NAHB, in conjunction with AARP, in like 2001 or so, created a special training program and certification called CAPS. And CAPS stands for Certified Aging in Place Specialist. So I taught that for many years all over the country to builders, designers, a couple of architects, reverse mortgage specialists, OTs, PTs, a range of people. It was very rewarding to teach it. And so that was one of the ways I was addressing the home environment. And recently, I've started to get a lot of requests to do some consultations for individual homes.
Yes.
But the thing is that, you know, for me, in addition to doing all those types of projects, you have to understand that these issues are so monumental. We are so behind the eight ball. Is that the expression? We're so behind in terms of changing our housing stock to make it work for real people, that I'm trying to do it as much as possible on a larger scale, you know. And I have some friends who are around my age. I'm in my early 50s, and they're already talking about retirement. And I'm mm-hmm. like, well, no, I have more than a lifetime's worth of work left to do on these issues. So you're right, Heather. I'm interested in it from all perspectives, and mostly I'm trying to reach, I guess one of my goals is to reach and impact the largest number of people possible with each project. And that varies.
Well, and I'm so glad you mentioned CAPS, because the Certified Aging in Place Specialist, because you're so good. I was going to ask you about that. And for listeners, since it sounds like they shouldn't necessarily connect with you for their own home needs, but maybe, I know I have older family members in another state, and just 2 weeks ago, they're doing some home remodel, and my husband and I are familiar with this, so we went on so listeners, you can go on the National Association of Home Builders website. I don't know what it is, like NAHB.org. And you can look up these special certifications, and you can look up, do you have CAPS, and I'll just tell you, we were looking up who are the CAPS certified professionals in the Denver area,
yes.
and we found a list, and yes. so we connected with them, because we thought, well, if we're going to do some remodeling or rethinking of a home for folks in their late 70s, we mm-hmm. want to make sure that we are bringing in the professionals, and that's how we found the person. So mm-hmm. listeners, you can do that here in our area to help you. Or yes. you looked at me, I mean, or they connect with you. I mean, this yes, is not a commercial for the...
They can go to my website. There's a contact page, and they can fill it out and ask me questions. But I'm getting so many requests that I'm revisiting that. I've done several projects in the past, but trying to find the balance between mm-hmm. all of these. But please, you know, consumers reach out to me, and at the very least, I can direct them to some helpful information if I can't work with them directly.
Great. And that's where also I'll give a shout out to our friends at the Orange County Department on Aging. I think it's my show on August 3rd or August 4th. We're going to be talking to their accessible design folks mm-hmm. and some folks from the community. So this will be an ongoing topic for the show, how people can create that fit in their own homes, because it is true. If the fit's not working, it does prematurely... I love how you say it creates what, false frailty or
forced
frailty.
Yeah, it forces a person into frailty prematurely or unnecessarily.
And I hear all the time, and I'm sure you do too, I want it from folks. I want to stay in my own home. I want to age in place. I want to stay in my home. And I say back to them, I know you love your home. Does your home love you back?
That's perfect. You know, I met a woman at the Chapel Hill Library a few months ago, and we started talking, and she asked what I do, and I told her, and she said, you know, my husband and I moved into our house when we were in our mid-30s, and we're in our mid-70s now. She's like, I really regret that we hadn't thought about mm-hmm. our needs when we're older. And my response to her was, why should you have to?
Yeah.
Which relates to yeah. another issue.
If your house just automatically was supportive, here, keep going, and then I'm going to rant on that.
I mean, why should you have to think, can I age in this house, or do I have to make changes? And which relates to another really important issue is the concept of home modifications.
Yes.
So I have... I really appreciate home modifications. That's one of the aspects of the CAPS program, is either building a new home or a new addition that is, you know, enables you to successfully age in place. And it's not just age in place, because most people just age in place by default.
Yes.
It's successfully aging in place be the goal. But you may have a professional help you modify your home. As much as I support that, if you pull the lens back and you look at it through all the things we talked about today, why on earth should an older person in their 60s, 70s, 80s have to spend their own money to modify a home that wasn't designed for the lifespan and the ability span?
Ooh, go on.
And I want to be really, really clear that there's no blame on builders, developers, designers, architects. Even now, a lot of programs don't teach these things, these concepts properly. They don't. I've been involved in programs or learned about design programs where they spend, you know, in a 4-year program, you spend 3 weeks at the most on universal design.
Yeah.
and if you're going to spend 3 weeks on it, then after that, are you expecting of the students that it's an integral part of every design that they create? The answer is no.
Yeah.
So I'm not blaming anybody, but what I'm saying now is that we know enough, we need to shift. So we need to shift our housing stock. One thing that I see with municipalities is they'll approve a housing development and they're just reinforcing the disabling status quo because it's not designed for anything different.
Yeah.
I see for accessory dwelling units, municipalities put out floor plans that are pre-approved, which is a huge help
But
why aren't they universally designed? Why aren't they visitable? It's an opportunity to start changing the housing stock immediately.
I'm so glad you brought up that point, because first of all, within the educational point, if we value it, we teach it, and we teach it for more than 3 weeks. But I'm very glad you were starting to talk into the role of municipalities and what they can do to incentivize, but also what they can do to hinder. And I know that there are permitting issues and planning issues where this whole issue of multiple main bedrooms, multiple kitchens, accessory dwelling units, that how do we also, can we legislate a little bit to be more supportive, or at least change some of the government permitting and planning, or, you know, how they do their, as you just said, their blueprints, to be more supportive? Because I've also just keep hearing story after story about how our permitting process or approval process can also get in the way of good multi-generational and aging in place design. So
yeah,
let's throw them under the bus a little
no,
bit.
No, so, I'm okay, not going to.
I know I say that as a joke, because you're like, I want to be very supportive.
Well, not only, I mean, I've been very involved in planning. I co-authored the American Planning Association's Aging and Community Policy Guide. But also my husband is involved in that work professionally in this region.
Good. And so you see it both ways.
I don't think there's any reason to throw any professionals under the bus. That's why I'm very clear. Back to what I said earlier about designers, architects, builders, what is the training they've had, and what conditions are they operating in, right? They have millions of codes,
yes,
that they have to comply with. So if something is optional, why would they incorporate it?
Yeah.
I don't really know about any of the problems with the permitting process that you're talking about.
I think I'm just kind of conflating codes and permitting and all of, but I do know
it's
that there can
one,
be things that
But it's also one piece
way.
Of the wheel, you know, one piece yes. of the puzzle. And I think one thing is that municipalities can recognize that their housing stock and their public spaces are really untapped resources. They can shift the way these places are designed to enable people of all ages and all abilities and all sizes, including shorties like you and I, to thrive, right? We want people to be at their highest level of functioning, highest level of independence, so that they can be physically, financially, cognitively as independent as possible and great members of a community. And there's a lot of components to that. You talked about education
yes.
a few minutes ago. There also has to be continuing education for professionals, because
exactly.
it's been a while since I've been in school. I need to know what these issues are.
Well, and there's so many issues we've discussed. I promise I'd give you a few minute warning. We've got about 3 minutes left. We have touched on so many important topics. Are there other issues that you're working on now, or that you want to make sure our listeners take away from this conversation as they think about their own pillar one, their own environmental fit with their space?
Right. So we talked about the cost-benefit analysis before.
Yeah.
That's not where I normally go to, because, like I keep saying, this is my life's work.
Yeah.
I am working to make these changes because it's the right thing to do. But that's often not how decisions are made in our society, in on the family level, on the community level, in corporations. There usually has to be some kind of economic analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll give you one point. At the age of 65, a woman is projected to spend almost $50,000 more than a 65-year-old man for wow. long-term care.
Wow.
And that's because,
why? Yeah,
yes, because the woman is likely to live with chronic health conditions requiring assistance for an average of 12 years. The man for 3 years. The woman is likely to, if she has any family caregivers, she's missing one key caregiver that the man has.
A wife.
A wife.
Unless, yes, well, you know, it'd be same-sex couples, but yes, in terms of the stereotypical,
right,
who's caring for an right older gentleman, it's, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. And there are plenty of men that are caring for their wives, but statistically there are fewer, significantly fewer of them.
Or in my case, daughters. Since right. We are both daughters, right, who are caregivers for our parents.
Right. So think about that. And the other thing I really want to leave people with, whether you in the audience, whether you're a consumer, whether you work for a municipality, you're a builder, you work for a corporation, is we have this amazing untapped power. We have environments that are unnecessarily, and for most people, unknowingly creating problems for us. And it doesn't have to be that way. So I invite all of you in your own way, in your own work, in your own lives, to harness the power of the built environment to enable people to thrive.
Esther Greenhouse, I cannot thank you enough for coming on Aging Well Together. This was amazing. I can't wait for you to come back. This was such a wonderfully helpful discussion, and I know my mind is getting bigger and bigger with all these ideas. For our listeners, you can reach Esther Greenhouse. She's the CEO of Silver to Gold Strategies at silvertogoldstrategies.com. Thank you all for listening to WCOM LP 103.5 Aging Well Together, and look forward to talking with y'all next week.